Welcome to the Fusion Forest podcast here on AshevilleFM.org. I'm your host, Leaf, and this show will feature discussions of environmental science, nature, eco-philosophy, and community environmental issues. And it could involve more, really whatever the guests that come on to the show want to talk about. Now, these conversations are taken from segments that originally aired on the Fusion Forest radio show on 103.3 Asheville FM, but instead of being aired in segments with musical interludes, you'll get to hear the entire conversation as they happened in their entirety, and with some of the longer conversations, there will be bonus segments that did not air on the broadcast episodes on 103.3. This first inaugural episode of the Fusion Forest podcast will feature my discussion with animal biologist Claire Adams, which occurred on July 5th, 2020, and originally aired on the Fusion Forest during the August 3rd and August 10th episodes. Claire is a researcher at the University of Otago in New Zealand. And we talk about her current research, which focuses on fur seals, abalone, more of a marine biology, also delving into some of her previous research at Iowa State with turtles, and we get into a few other random topics. But the scientific research that we talk about is accomplished through methods surrounding environmental DNA analysis, which Claire will explain what that is in this conversation and what some of its uses are. She was a delightful guest to have on the show and is doing really good, interesting work out there, so hope you enjoy this conversation here in the Fusion Forest podcast on Asheville FM. I am pleased to be joined right now by Claire Adams, a animal biologist with a Master's of Science degree, who's currently working on a PhD, doing some interesting research on animal biology and genetics. Claire, thanks for joining me here.
Hey, Leaf. It's nice to join you here, too.
So, Claire, where are you doing your PhD research?
I'm doing my PhD research down here at the University of Otago in New Zealand.
Wow, okay. Down under. Did they say that New Zealand or is that just Australia?
Nah, it's a real country, although sometimes it doesn't pop up on the maps.
Yeah, well, it's real though, apparently, because I'm talking to you from there right now. You're doing animal biology research there, right? What kind of animals are you working with?
Yeah, so I'm working with two species. So one is what we call Pala, or Haliotis iris, which is the New Zealand blackfoot abalone. Abalones are a gastropod. They can be found on rocky shores and sandy bottomed coastlines. They're a commonly fish species. Specifically, they're used in a lot of traditional Maori fisheries as well here. And my other species that I'm working with is the New Zealand fur seal, Arctocephalus fosteri. So these were hunted by both Maori and Paheka white people, and their populations dropped down to about 2% of their original population. But thankfully, with excellent conservation efforts from the Department of Conservation, we're seeing them repopulating from the subantarctic islands and traveling back up throughout New Zealand.
Oh, wow. That's great to hear. And so both of those species are traditional food sources in New Zealand then, and that's what's causing the species decline initially?
Yeah. So they were both hunted for food, and fur seals especially were hunted for their fur.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a nice luxurious thing to have.
Yeah, cool. So I want to ask you a little bit more about abalone before we move on, because I mean it's just like it's a cool name for an animal in general, but and we see their shells a lot of times. They're these like very shiny, beautiful iridescent shells. But you were saying they're a mollusk. They're like similar to
yeah. So
what kind of animals are they similar to?
I guess they're kind of similar to a snail, right? They've got a really big foot. They're actually called gastropods, and if we break that word down, that's stomach foot. So they crawl around on their stomach and they'll eat algae. These specifically eat seaweed down here, and they just sort of chill on rocks. They're actually kind of fast when they want to move, but most of the time they just sort of sit on rocks and eat the seaweed and live a pretty great life until,
Interesting.
somebody comes along and decides that they want to eat them and pops them off rocks and chops them up. But
And they're grazers then. They're like
herbivorous.
little sheep or cattle of the ocean. Have you ever eaten the New Zealand black abalone before? Would that be a
No, I actually
conflict of
haven't.
interest for you to do that since you're trying to conserve them?
Well, with the way that fisheries are currently around the globe, actually, we're actually expected to have a collapse of fisheries by about 2050. About 90% of fisheries are going to collapse. So I decided I didn't really want to contribute to that. And that's just a personal choice.
Yeah. What other animals besides humans like to eat abalone?
Not entirely sure, actually. I don't think that a ton of other creatures do when they become really big adults.
There's not like walruses there, are there? I would be
No, I
imagining
mean
something.
there's a lot of like seals and sea lions and stuff, but I don't think that they go so much. They'll more go for squid and fish.
Yeah, because I mean, I know walruses. I don't know if there's other, but it's like the large marine mammals that have big tusks. They use that to rip things out of crab shells. And so let's talk about the seals a little bit. We mentioned the fur seals already, and is this a species that's more located in the Oceania area, or is this type of seal exists all over the world?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different pinnipeds or seals and sea lions around. The New Zealand fur seal is actually what a lot of Americans would consider the sea lion because it has back flippers that face forwards. So these seals are found mainly in the subantarctic islands, mainly around New Zealand and a little bit of maybe the south of Australia. My lab has done some genetic studies in the past looking at if these seals inbreed and stuff between Australia and New Zealand. But we found that there seem to be about three distinct-ish populations. So one in Australia, one on the west coast of New Zealand, and one on the east coast of New Zealand. And so now what we're doing with our research is we're trying to see if we can pick up that genetic variation strictly from the water.
Oh wow. Yeah, so you're doing genetic work on these two species, right? And you were mentioning fisheries earlier. Does the genetic work have to do with comparing them in fishery areas? What's the basis of that?
Right. So right now we're doing something called environmental DNA. So environmental DNA is basically taking DNA out of the water. So how does this happen? Well, creatures like any other animal are going to be shedding out through their poo, their pee, their shed skin cells, their DNA into the water. And then as scientists, we can come and we can extract that from environmental samples and then sequence it so we can look and see what genetic information is there without actually having to sample the animal itself.
Okay, so you're measuring the residues of animals that would have their genetic information on them. It's like the crime lab in CSI or whatever, right? Except for it's
Yeah,
everything
so we're
there.
basically like animal CSI people
Yeah.
without having to like go out and either tranquilize or shoot a seal for a tissue sample. We can try and
Yeah.
look at their genetics. Yeah,
It's a lot
through
less
that method.
invasive that way. So that's pretty cool. And when for in case anyone cares, when you're talking about extracting DNA to sequence it, what are you physically doing to get the DNA out of the water sample?
So what we generally do is we go out, we fill up a bucket, which is a very high-tech bucket. No, I'm just kidding. And we put the water through a filter. And so that filter will trap the DNA or the skin cells or, fecal cells or whatever. And then from that, we can extract out the genetic material with commercial kits. And then from there, we'll use specific primers to try and search for the needle in the haystack of what DNA we want to see.
Okay, and primers are a topic. I act like I understand them, but maybe I couldn't just specifically define them, but is it like a chemical that amplifies certain parts of the DNA sequence?
Yeah, so primers are just little short fragments of DNA. So when you're doing a PCR, which is a general genetic technique, which we use to increase the amount of DNA so that we can actually distinguish that little bit of DNA from the rest of the background DNA, we use the primers to get that little part that we're interested in. So if we're really interested in, for example, seal DNA, we'll use our primers to amplify out seal DNA and therefore end up with something that we can sequence or look at what the base pairs actually are, and then match that up in our database with what our water sample is.
Okay, cool. And what's the goal of sequencing this DNA? What are you trying to figure out from collecting it and measuring it?
So specifically, my project is looking at the genetic diversity of these animals. So for example, we want to know if a population, so for example, seals is inbred or if it's really genetically diverse. So generally, as scientists and conservation biologists, we think of more diverse as better because our animals will have a better potential to evolve and weather any incoming changes through evolution and adaptation.
Yeah, so the more diversity there is, it makes it so there's a higher chance that the population would be able to overcome some sort of challenge or some sort of environmental disturbance. The more diverse population makes it so that either the population of animals or the ecosystem itself can adapt to pollution, or it gets warmer, or if part of the ecosystem disappears or a food source disappears, there's a bigger reservoir of genes and abilities that could potentially be drawn upon.
Precisely like that. Yeah. And I mean, additionally, if everything is really homogeneous as well, so if everything is the same in terms of genetics, we'll also see things like inbreeding depression. So for example, I mean, if you even imagine the famous czars in Russia, right? They all had hemophilia. So you could get fixed for some deleterious allele or some disease and not be able to escape that if you don't have enough variation in your population.
Yeah. So if there's something arises that is really hard on animals of a population and they don't have any genetic diversity, it's going to hit them all really hard.
And then you would see a mass extinction and nobody wants to see their seals to not be there anymore.
No, because they're such they're cute and majestic and fierce, and some cultures get a lot of economic value out of them, so they serve a lot of roles, it sounds like. And it's interesting because when you're saying PCR, and I was kind of thinking like PCR, I wonder how many people even know what that is, but I feel like more people probably know what PCR is now than, like, in terms of the general public being aware of PCR and why it's important. It's probably way bigger now than it's really ever been, because of like, that's like one of the main tests for people to see if they have the SARS-CoV-2 virus in them, right?
Right. And it's just a really common genetic technique that we have in order to actually hone in on the specific pieces of DNA that we want to see.
So have you gotten any interesting results yet in this research, either with the fur seals or with the New Zealand black abalones, about are they inbred, are they not, or?
So one of my projects is comparing tissue samples and environmental DNA. I'm working on the environmental DNA part right now, so I can't quite share those results with you, but from the tissue samples, we're seeing that the abalone are actually pretty inbred, which is not super great for the abalone fishery. And we're able to get seal eDNA out of the water in actually pretty high quantities. Usually environmental DNA is quite low in terms of the amount that we would find compared to a regular tissue sample. Obviously, because we're pulling out just traces of it from the environment compared to actual blood or tissue samples.
And so it's the seals, there's a lot of environmental DNA, but not the abalone.
Yeah, and I think that could be just because seals are a little bit messier. Our abalone just sort of stick on rocks and they don't move around too much, so they're shedding out a little bit less, I think.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you if, like, you think it has anything to do with, like, all the fur that seals have, that, like, they're shedding their hairs, or if that could be a potential reason why there's more of them than the shellfish.
Yeah, definitely. I think that they're pooping, they're peeing, they're moving around a lot. When we went seal sampling for environmental DNA up at Kaikoura, there were a couple pools full of seal pups, and they were all playing around in the tide pools and water, and it was really cute. And we were able to grab some water from those pools, so hopefully we'll be able to see some traces of environmental DNA from those samples.
Nice. Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah, it's funny. I had a little bit of experience with seals when I was in undergrad. I was doing a senior class on behavioral ecology. So we went to this elephant seal breeding ground off of the coast of California. And so those animals are somewhat repulsive, but really only the adult males, though. It's like they had all these cute elephant seal pups, and then the females just look like normal seals, and the males just have these, like, weird-looking noses, and they're loud and make a bunch of sounds. It just sounds like burping and farting nonstop, and then they're, like, fighting each other and sitting on the babies, and it was a big mess. But, you know, I think, I mean, elephant seals are, like, an exceptionally messy seal, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I don't really know about that. I was really surprised that when we did go to do some field sampling, that I felt like I was in a Star Wars movie, because all the seals were, like, making Wookiee noises, and I was, like, so surprised that they actually made these vocalizations. I mean, I did expect some smell, but it was a little overpowering at times.
Yeah, that's funny. I was actually, there's a big marine research lab at UC Santa Cruz, and there's a lot of marine mammals around that part of the world. And so the UC Santa Cruz mascot is the banana slugs, which is, you know, named after this large yellow slug that's very abundant in the redwood forests around there. And when the school got a real sports program and joined the NCAA, they decided to change the mascot name from banana slug to the sea lion, because they wanted something that was a little more, like, intimidating and fierce.
Did they really?
Yeah, they did, but they changed it back to the banana slug, like, right after, because there were big protests afterwards. The students were not happy about having their identity taken away as the banana slugs, so...
I thought that was one thing that they were really, really famous for.
They were, so, yeah. I mean, you see how damaging of a move it would have been to have become the sea lions. They would have, you know, kind of withered away into obscurity. But
too common.
Yeah. I try something unique. Now, and I don't know, is there any schools that are mascots are named after abalone? Or is that still on the table?
Yeah, not that I know of. I know that there is some research on abalone going on in California, because they've got a red abalone fishery going on there. But I don't really know if any schools have that. It's not quite a frightening mascot, to be sure.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking of a school. I don't think it's abalone, but I think it's Evergreen State has the gooey duck. The Pacific gooey duck is a species of very large edible saltwater clam. So yes, Evergreen State College, they're the gooey ducks. I think that's the closest I know to an abalone mascot. So they might have even outdone the banana slugs on that one. You've been doing this more marine research and kind of on ocean organisms recently, but your background was with different types of animals, right?
Right. So during my master's, I studied at Iowa State University looking at the environmental DNA of painted turtles. So these can be found throughout the United States, and we're able to find a little bit of painted turtle environmental DNA. We were looking specifically at abundances of painted turtles and seeing if more painted turtles in ponds would shed out more environmental DNA, but those results were a little inconclusive, even though the research currently suggests that we're able to find some slight correlation between abundance and biomass, or abundance of turtles.
The data is often messy in these types of ecological DNA research because I'm sure there's a whole litany of reasons why it could be messy, but there's just a lot of stuff that could be floating around in that water.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons that environmental DNA is really difficult is that we are looking for very small amounts of DNA. And oftentimes, for example, when I was studying turtles, the water wasn't super clear. Like, it was very murky. It had a lot of inhibitors. I think one time when we drained the ponds, we found a lot of corn at the bottom of the pond. And so plants have a lot of inhibitory compounds that actually stop us from amplifying DNA very well. So there's definitely a lot of challenges that we face in the
That's
field.
interesting. These plant inhibitor compounds, do you know what those compounds are, or what classic compounds, or what their like original purpose is in the plants? Because I imagine the plants didn't evolve them to like mess up people's DNA sequencing studies.
No, plants are not evil or anything. Plants are just doing what they do best and trying to defend themselves. So sometimes these are polysaccharides or tannins. So you can find tannins commonly in wine
Okay.
or even brackish water. So water that's kind of brown might be because of tannic content
Are
or humic
those,
acids.
yeah, are tannins, do they have like an antibiotic property? Or I know they're important in the biochemistry of plants.
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
No. All right.
They're just really annoying.
Are the tannins are one of the main things that's getting in the way of the environmental DNA samples?
Tannins and humic acids, so actually things from soil,
Yeah,
can get in the
there's
way.
soil. Everything always gets in the way in soil. It's a tough nut to crack. Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about the painted turtle. It sounds like it's one that lives in the water a lot.
Yeah,
Maybe.
so it's a semi-aquatic turtle that's found across the US. It's a good model species because it models other more rare turtles like the Blanding's turtle, which is currently threatened and/or endangered in some states. It's kind of cute. They're usually black on the top of their shell or carapace, and then they've got usually some sort of brightish coloring. At least the Western painted turtle has some bright, often red and black coloring on their belly shell or their plastron. And then the eastern painted turtle is
Wait,
often.
you said the plastron. That's the name of the belly shell of a turtle.
Yeah.
That's cool. I never knew that.
Yep. So the carapace is the top part and the plastron is the bottom part. Then the sort of on their sides is called the bridge, and it's all attached to their rib cage. So never take a turtle out of its shell because you're essentially trying to rip it off from its rib cage, and that's just terrible.
Yeah, so they can't pop out of their shell and go take a shower like in the old Looney Tunes cartoons.
No, unfortunately not.
Oh, bummer. But so the fact that turtles do have this hard shell that's connected to their body, like that's a pretty good defensive mechanism. A lot of the oldest land animals are turtles, right?
Turtles can live for a very long time. You've got the Galapagos tortoises that live around, they can live, up to 200 or so years. But I think it also just varies by species as well. So I think a recent study that we were doing back at Iowa State was that they were looking at mark recapture and seeing, like, when do we start seeing these turtles and when do we stop seeing these turtles? And we're talking about nesting mothers, and I think that they basically found that after about 30 years or so, we start seeing a drop off of individuals just not returning. So we're thinking that maybe turtles, we think of them as really long lived and slow reproducing, but Maybe they actually do, they senesce, they start to get old and they start to die off around 30 years or so, whereas our original thought was that they just wouldn't do that and they just keep living until something ate them or they got chopped up by a boat propeller or something.
Interesting. Because I had heard that idea floated out there before, that turtles just keep growing and getting older indefinitely.
For example, we usually see that there's like a growth curve and that they keep adding, a few millimeters onto their shell and keep growing. So they never ne necessarily stop, but it just slows down. So I think we're seeing some of that, but I think we're also seeing that there does become a point in which they do die and it varies between species, and that's something that really needs to be studied.
What is the main diet of the painted turtle, and is there a lot of variation in turtle diets from different species to species, or is there kind of a common set of food that turtles usually eat?
I think that the common wisdom is that hatchlings will eat a little bit more meat, so in terms of insects and other sources of protein, whereas adults are more herbivorous, so they'll eat more plants and things like that. So whatever aquatic plants are growing around their habitat. I wouldn't be surprised if they tended to be more towards one or the other side, but were omnivorous and ended up eating both. And that's specifically for the painted turtle, but obviously a lot of other turtles, depending on what species they are and what habitat they're in, will be eating different things.
That's interesting. I recently saw a juvenile box turtle. I guess it's the eastern box turtle. Like the terrapins. I don't know
Yeah,
what it is.
Terrapin carolina, yeah.
Yeah, that's the scientific name, right? So I was walking around. And I saw one as a juvenile. Maybe its shell was like 5 inches in diameter or so, and it had really bright colorings on it. And I walked by it on this trail, and then I walked back the other way, and it was still there, but it had this really big cricket like hanging out of its mouth that was too big for it to eat all at once. So it was like take a bite and then sit there for 10 or 15 seconds and then slightly regurgitate it and then take another bite. And it took it like maybe 5 or 10 minutes and they ate this whole cricket. But I think that was the first time it dawned on me that turtles eat animals. And it's actually funny because this little turtle had some kind of like yellow goo on its, not that they have lips, but on the outside of its mouth. And it made me think of a time in the past when I'd found this turtle that was sitting like in the road, and I moved it and it just kept sitting there and not moving, and it had all this yellow goo hanging out of its mouth, and I thought that it was sick and it had like vomited or something. And I was like, well, you gotta take it easy, man. But then I think it probably was just eating some sort of bug and hadn't cleaned up, and that's probably why it wasn't moving, because it was content because it just fed. Or
Could
maybe
be, yeah.
solving a
Yeah.
big mystery of an earlier time in my life. But yeah, turtles are great. I'm a big fan of turtles. I know you're a big fan of turtles, and
Yeah.
I've been seeing more and more turtles recently around Western North Carolina, which has been exciting. There was a stretch where I didn't see any for like several years, and
Wow, that's really incredible. Actually, I think one of the researchers, Ann Barry Summers, down at UNCG, actually does some turtle research. I know that they've started training some dogs to go out and sniff and find them, actually. So bring them back to the researchers so the researchers can actually get some measurement data, like how big is the turtle? Is it, female or male? Like, where is the turtle in terms of its home range? And then be able to study them that way, because they are kind of hard to find, but I'm really glad that you're seeing more.
Yeah, the dog is going and finding it, and then they follow the dog out to the turtle, or is the dog actually picking up the turtle and bringing it back to them, fetching the turtles? That sounds stressful.
It could be both. I think that they've trained these dogs, if they are picking them up, to handle the turtles very gently. I think that they're trying to use dog breeds like Labs and maybe retrievers and stuff that have really a soft bite, so a delicate grip to be able to carry these turtles back to the researchers.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know how familiar you are with the eastern box turtle, but I know They have two different visual appearances. Sometimes their coloring is darker because, you know, like their shell is like black and kind of yellowish orange. And sometimes they're darker and sometimes their colors are really bright and like bright yellow. Some of them have really deep red eyes and some of them, the eyes are a little of a blander color. And some have like a notch on the bottom of the shell and some don't. And that's a way to determine whether it's a male or female, right?
I mean, generally females will have shorter tails and males will have longer tails. And I believe that males have a more domed plastron so that they can more easily mount the females. And I think, but don't 100% quote me on this, that the males have the red eye and that the females have the yellow eye. But I don't know so much about the coloration, if that's between species or between sexes or just general variation in terms of something like genetic diversity or adaptation and plasticity.
Yeah, I remember when I was a little kid, found a little box turtle. It was, you know, maybe a few inches in diameter, and I wanted to keep it, and so I took it and I stuck it in my bathtub at home and put some like grass and stuff in the bathtub and had it there as a pet for like a day or two. But then my parents told me I should probably put it back out in the woods because it wasn't gonna do well in the bathtub its whole life. So I did, and I remember I was like, I want to know if I ever run into this turtle again. I was like, I can't put some sort of blatant marking on it because that might mess up its survival chances. So I got some yellow paint and like painted like some dots and lines on it, and it probably would have washed off in the rain. I probably wouldn't have seen it again, but it was you know, it was one, you know, one of the early experiences of, you know, being fascinated with reptiles, but kind of like you interact with them in a different way. I'm definitely not trying to, you know, diss pet reptiles. You know, there's a lot of cool pets you can have, but having a pet reptile is not like something you're really playing with and interacting with as much. Some people do that with snakes, but like you got like a lizard or a turtle that's in an aquarium. It's not like having like a dog that's going to come up on your lap or, you
For
know.
sure. It's not exactly the same. Funny story, I actually did have a ball python or a snake when I was studying in both undergrad and in during my master's. But I went to move to New Zealand and apparently there are no snakes here and they would not allow me to take my snake into the country. And so I had to give him away to a friend.
That's too bad. I guess I can see their reasoning for that.
Yeah, no, it's totally legitimate. New Zealand has a ton of problems with invasive animals, just c completely wrecking all of the fauna here, especially
Yeah.
all the birds.
I bet, 'cause that's such a an isolated area of the world ecologically, and I know Australia's got a lot of problems with invasive animals, and Hawaii too, and yeah, it's
Yeah, I mean, famous example I think is like Guam and all of the brown tree snakes that ended up killing a lot of the birds, I think.
yeah. Did you ever hear the story about it was in Hawaii, I think, and there was a foreign snake that had gotten onto the island and had really proliferated and it was eating a bunch of birds and then kind of doing a bunch of damage to the ecosystem. So these scientists decided they would combat the snakes by releasing a mongoose on the island to eat the snakes. But they released the mongoose and it didn't fix anything because the mongoose were nocturnal and the snakes were diurnal, so they weren't actually awake at the same time of the day. And it was kind of
Rough.
like a like wow, that was a big project to overlook that detail.
That's why it always pays to do your science before embarking on something like that.
Yeah, science is important, right? It's kind of how we figure out what's going on in the world around us. You know, it's good to get it out there. One more note on the, you know, obscure pets and aquariums. I was just talking to a friend of mine about octopuses. He was talking to someone who thought octopus is really cool and was talking about getting a pet octopus. And whoever the person talked to, it was like the pet store owner or the octopus expert, basically told them that you probably don't want to get a pet octopus because they are can squeeze their bodies through really small spaces, and they also can move around like outside of water if they're wet. And so they're saying people who do have pet octopuses, a lot of times they'll go to their aquarium and it's not there, and then they come back the next day and it's in there. So an octopus,
wow, yeah,
I'm out of the aquarium and crawl around your house. And I'm just imagining like the worst case scenario, or I don't, maybe not the worst case scenario, but probably the freakiest scenario, where you fall asleep and wake up in the middle of the night and the octopus is like sitting on your chest in your bed. And
yeah, I too cannot recommend octopi for pets. I actually interned at an aquarium when I was in college, and they had one there, and they had to lock it down in terms of lock and key and making sure that interns didn't like go near it except when a keeper was there, because they're so strong that they are able to pick things up and move things around, and they're also able to go through really tight spaces. There's all these stories about aquariums that do try and have octopi, and they see that some of their tanks end up missing fish, and they're like, oh, like, why are our fish missing? Like, what's going on? And they set up a video camera, and then they find, oh, like, it's the octopus getting out, and during the night, it'll just go and crawl into this other tank, eat a few fish, and then crawl back into its regular tank. Like, they're really clever, too. So even trying to have it, being able to try and entertain and, you know, successfully enrich an octopus at home's aquarium would be so difficult.
Yeah, to keep them stimulated and not getting bored.
It's not like a dog or a cat at all.
Yeah, that reminds me of when I was in like elementary school. We had a class aquarium once. It had all these fish in it, and one of our classmates had a pet turtle, and he was like, let's put the turtle in the aquarium. And we're like, yeah, cool. And put the turtle in the aquarium. And then we had like a long weekend, it was a holiday or something, and everyone was gone from school for 3 or 4 days. And we came back and there was pretty much no fish in the aquarium, but the turtle was still there. And we were like, oh no, what happened to all the fish? And it looked like the turtle ate them. But the kid whose turtle it was extremely defensive and was like, no, the turtle didn't do it. My turtle doesn't, turtles don't eat fish. There's no way my turtle would have done that. And we're kind of like, yeah, I don't know, man. Like, kind of. this alternate explanation it's gonna be tough to figure out. The fish jump out. Yeah. We're like looking around the aquarium, so you're like, no, they didn't jump out and fall on the ground.
Yeah, I had a turtle, and she loved to eat feeder fish. So I can imagine a turtle ending up eating those fish. It was really funny, actually, because our turtle would end up kind of like hibernating a little bit over the winter. So we'd put in a couple of feeder fish around there during maybe November or so. And then she wouldn't eat anything until like suddenly like a switch turned on in like April. And then she went zooming around the tank, like trying to eat this like now massive fish that had grown in her tank for like several months. So it was so funny to see her try and chase it all around.
Yeah. Did she get the fish? Eventually,
she cornered it behind the filter.
From aquariums to the Pacific Ocean, we've been talking about all sorts of animal activity. Do you have any closing thoughts or messages you'd like to get out there to the Asheville community and the greater community about, you know, whatever turtles, environmental DNA, seals, abalone?
Well, there's certainly a lot to explore with science. So I think it's really just important to keep an open mind and, you know, just make sure that you're open to new experiences and exploring the natural world.
Cool. And before we go, can you say again what the university you work at is and what your lab is? So if people want to like look up your research or follow it, they can do that.
Yeah, sure. So my Twitter handle is Claire, C-L-A-R-E. _ eDNA, so E and then DNA. And then I work at the University of Otago. This is O-T-A-G-O, down here in New Zealand.
Well, thanks so much for joining me, Claire, and to all the listeners out there, if you found any of this interesting, follow her on Twitter at Claire_eDNA. and keep learning about all the animals out there. Because why not? They're our distant relatives, so might as well get to know them. Stay curious, my friends. Don't be afraid to learn more about what's going on out there in nature. Well, thanks to Claire for sharing her knowledge and wisdom. If you found any of that interesting, you can follow her on Twitter at Claire, E-D-N-A, C-L-A-R-E, underscore, E-D-N-A, on Twitter, and look her up at the University of Otago. Well, thanks for listening, folks, and keep checking the AshevilleFM.org website and that podcast page for new updates and new episodes of the Fusion Forest podcast, as well as all of our other podcast programming. You can follow the Fusion Forest on Instagram at the Fusion Forest for announcements of new episodes being released, and listen to the Fusion Forest on Asheville FM 103.3 FM. Thanks for joining, and you have a good whatever it is you're doing next.